equation there, just so we've got it kind of in the back of our minds. I'm going to be using it a bit later. And so I want to sort of finish off the topic of connections and curvature by just, again, reminding you about the curvature of a connection. So remember that in gauge theories, we have a bit of an analogy with geometry or gravitational physics. So we've got this idea that to make a particular symmetry of a theory local, we add in a gauge field. So you'll be familiar with the gauge covariant derivative of a charge scalar would be in flat space, generally. You change the spatial derivative to a gauge covariant derivative by adding in an extra gauge potential there. So we're going to sort of imagine this in analogy with our expression for in abstract index notation. For the covariant derivative of a vector. So it's kind of analogous. Okay. So a way of defining our electromagnetic field from this perspective comes from looking at a commutator of the gauge covariant derivatives. So here, when we do our field strength, we simply pick up, if we take a commutator of gauge covariant derivatives, we pick up a piece that looks like dA. And then if A is not abelian, we also pick up a commutator term for the A's. So that's how we define a general field strength. And so really we're kind of going to do essentially the same thing for the curvature. The curvature is going to be a commutator of covariant derivatives. So we take, that's our equivalent of a commutator. We take the derivative along v then u, then subtract the derivative along u then v. And then if u and v don't commute, we also have to add in an extra term based on the Lie bracket of u and v. So you would, curvature can often, you can think physically of curvature in terms of parallel transport round a closed loop. And if you parallel transport a vector around a closed loop, it doesn't quite come back to itself. But in order to transport around a closed loop, we saw earlier on this morning that the Lie bracket tells you by how far the loop defined by U and V doesn't close. So this is really, if you like, closing the loop, and meaning that curvature is telling you something about how parallel transport around loops doesn't bring you back to where you started, if you're thinking about it sort of pictorially or physically. So in components, in components, you get something which hopefully is familiar, the first four pieces, derivatives of the connection components, connection squared, anti-symmetrized, and the only so-called new bit, or maybe new bit if you haven't seen it before, is the last term, which is there, again, if the basis that you have chosen has non-zero structure constants. So again, if you're in a coordinate basis, these structure constants are all zero. The coordinate basis elements commute. And so you would just go back to the normal formula for the Riemann tensor in terms of the connection. But if you want to choose a general basis, then you have to add in that extra piece. So physically, what curvature is doing is telling you about tidal forces. And so you get, if you think about a space-time, with a set of observers who are sort of freely falling, this is the vector T. So the freely falling observers are going to tell us that they're geodesics. So again, this is familiar from the first GR course, that freely falling observers, inertial observers, are defined by geodesics, which if you affinely parameterize them, they're parameterized by proper time. And so you can label, let's say we've got, thinking of this as a surface, and we label them by some parameter S. So we're imagining that this is a surface of constant proper time. So this might be, we sort of set the clock rolling at this point here, where this is labeled by S. And then it's some small elapsed proper time along the geodesic, this would be, again, the surface of constant tau plus delta tau. So by construction, what I've done here, at least from a two-dimensional perspective, is I have made a coordinate, a local coordinate system for this this plane, a sort of surface swept out by these geodesics, which are formed by proper time parameterizing you along the world lines, and then some sort of spatial parameter taking you from one observer to the next. So if I think about it, I have constructed a local basis in which the structure constants are zero, because I have made my loops, my little curves, close. If I go a little bit along S and then a small amount delta tau, it's the same as going a small amount delta tau and then a little bit along S. So what that means is that the Riemann curvature, the curvature, if I act on this combination of the normal and tangent vectors, it means the Lie bracket vanishes, so I just get the commutator of covariant derivatives. But then grad t of t is zero, so the first term vanishes. And with the second term, grad n of t is going to be the same as grad t of n, because in the Lie bracket, you can actually replace the partial derivative by a covariant derivative. So that's an exercise to the reader. So what I end up with is saying that a sort of an acceleration of n along the world line is given by the curvature. And so this is really telling us how sorry?
Is it two covariant derivatives?
Yes, two tangent covariant derivatives. So really, this is just telling us something about how neighboring geodesics are being sort of squeezed together or moved apart. So I just did this example here in a sort of planar slice, but you can see how it would be true in general. So this is sort of telling us how geodesics converge or diverge or whatever. Which is, of course, what a tidal force is. So the only other thing I want to say about curvature is I want to define a curvature 2 form. So again, I'm taking my basis of both the vector and tangent and cotangent spaces, and I'm mopping up the last two parts, this part of the operator of R, by taking a basis for the sort of two-form space. And then I get Cartan's second structural equation, which I'm not going to prove. I'll let you have a go at that if you want. Which relates curvature to exterior derivatives of the connection one forms. So you can see from the familiar expression of that you would have recalled in a coordinate basis for the Riemann tensor in terms of an anti-symmetrized derivative of the connection components, that's kind of like that bit, the d theta, plus an anti-symmetric product of the gammas, and this is mirrored here in terms of the exterior product of the two connection one forms. So you can see how it's taking the component formula for the Riemann tensor. So it's you know, it doesn't sort of look like a silly thing to write down. But that's Cartan's second structural equation. So the point about these structural equations is that they're taking you from a particular space-time, a particular geometry, and getting you to compute connection components or curvature components simply by exterior differentiation, which is often extremely straightforward once you've written down what your basis of forms actually is. And this is a very effective way of computing curvature algebraically by hand. So I've got three examples that I want to work through with you, showing you how you actually apply these techniques.
That's on my map. Oh, I mean geodesic.
So, you mean what would the geodesic equation be, or what?
I mean it's physical mean.
Shall we come back to that at the end? And then we'll have a discussion at the end so I can try and understand what you're thinking or what the question is. It's probably better that way. So I gathered from some questions I got at the end of the last lecture that I'm going to have a bit of a tough gig trying to convince some of you that you should try and do computations by hand rather than putting them in an algebraic manipulator. But I'm going to try in part by some of these examples to at least try and illustrate where I think the use of a general method is, as well as the fact that once you start getting slightly more complicated expressions, sometimes algebraic manipulators don't spot very obvious cancellations. So the Cartan method is in fact a very effective way of computing curvature. Moreover, when you use it, it often makes it easier to spot patterns. So quite often when you're building up solutions to Einstein's equations, say in an arbitrary number of dimensions, and you maybe want to have sort of arbitrary subspaces, then what you tend to notice is patterns start to emerge, both in the way the connection looks as well as in the way the curvature looks. And this, again, can be an effective way of illustrating these patterns. So the first example is going to be a reasonably straightforward one, and that is we're just going to look at a simple plane fronted gravitational wave. That's a middle one, isn't it? So the metric is going to be almost flat. So that last dxi squared term just means dx1 squared plus dx2 squared. Nothing going on there. And the only thing that makes it not flat is that function h. So we're just going to say, can we choose an h such that this is a vacuum Einstein solution? So, if you like, step one is choose an orthonormal basis. So I've simply chosen a way of completing the square there with the time and space coordinates. So that if I take ds squared is now just eta AB omega A omega B. So that's my orthonormal basis. Because I've chosen an orthonormal basis, my connection components, my spin connection will be anti-symmetric. And I calculate it using Cartan's first equation. So let me look at what d of omega t is. When d acts on dt, it gives me 0. So all I get is 1/2 h, I dxi cross dt minus r. And that's the same as d omega r and d omega I is 0. So all I've done there is just taken d of the expressions, just simple derivative. So from Cartan's first equation, I'm saying I've got a metric connection, it's torsion-free. So d omega is just equal to minus theta wedge omega. So that's just applying Cartan's first equation. So if I look at what I've computed here, that would indicate, if I sort of looked at this, that this dt minus dr is simply omega t minus omega r. So I can read off what my connection forms are from simply looking at this relation here. So d of omega t, for example, would have to be minus theta t I wedge omega I. There's the omega I that's sort of staring me in the face. And so it's telling me that's what's left is the omega t piece. So all the other connection forms vanish. So you've got a theta TI, a theta RI, but no theta IJ. So then I want to calculate the curvature. So RTI is going to be d of theta TI. So this would just be transporting Cartan's second equation, applying it. Here, the only non-zero connection, spin connection term with a T means that the A has got to be a 1 or a 2, an I or a J, say. But theta JI vanishes, so that cross term is 0. So the only thing I get is taking the derivative of theta TI. So this is D of a half h comma I dt minus dr, which is a half h comma ij dxj cross dt minus dr. If I put it back in terms of the orthonormal basis, is just a half h comma ij omega j cross omega t minus omega r. Mm-hmm.
Why in d omega t you don't have terms like h comma t or h comma r?
So the point is that h depends on t minus r, right? So if you take, if I just wanted dh, so that's a fair question. If I do as an aside, dh is going to equal h comma I dxi, but then it's also going to have a term sort of d by dt minus r of h dt minus dr. However, you've already got a dt minus dr there. Same. So the two forms are parallel. So you're right. The exterior derivative of h is not just h comma I dxi, but the extra, it's like the third term it has, is already parallel to the form that's already there, the dt minus dr. So you don't see that term. So that's RTI. You can see that you get the same answer for the RI component. Which is the same as theta TI. And then the only other possible components that the curvature 2 form could have would be IJ components, which would have to be come from cross products of the spin connection because there's no theta ij. So if I look at what that is, that would have to be theta it cross theta tj plus theta ir cross theta rj. But now, I'm going, so we know what theta TJ is and what theta RJ is, but, so theta IT is simply raising the index on theta JT downstairs, which is minus theta tj . So basically, you've got to raise and lower indices with the Minkowski metric. And then when you swap the indices over, you get a minus sign. So this tells you that theta it is actually equal to theta ti, but that theta ir is minus theta ri. Orthonormal basis. It's something that you kind of got to keep reminding yourself that you've chosen an orthonormal basis. So whenever you see any of these indices, it means component in an orthonormal basis. And we'll sort of the second example kind of make that a little bit more explicit. So you're raising and lowering indices with eta because you've chosen an orthonormal basis. And what that means is that whereas because eta tt is plus 1, the theta it is equal to theta ti, because eta rr is minus 1, this has the opposite sign to that term. So this is in fact 0. And similarly, you can, or not similarly, you can just see that RTR is also 0. So that means I can peel off what the Riemann tensor is fairly straightforwardly. So if I want to peel off the components from the two form, the TI piece parts of the two form, here you see that there's something with a JT and something with a JR. So the JT piece is going to be H, IJ. Then that's going to be minus RTIJR. So that takes care of the Riemann component starting TI. For the one starting RI, I'm going to essentially get the same pattern. It's going to be also the same for RIJT and RIJR. So there's only one sort of independent component or function going on in the Riemann tensor, and that is the second derivative of H. So if I now get the Ricci tensor, so I get the Ricci tensor simply by contracting on first and third indices. So Rij is going to be RTITJ plus RIRJ. And you can see that these are the opposite sign. So I get 0. Meanwhile, if I want to get RTT, then I have to take my metric and contract on this I and J. So this is going to be minus delta IJ. RITIJ. like two sines, that's plus a half, which is just the Laplacian acting on H. So what this, Because it's just to the two spatial components, dxi squared, and so eta is minus one for each of them. That's why. So we have an Einstein solution. If H satisfies the Laplace equation. So that means I can write down any function which satisfies the Laplace equation with any profile in T minus R, and it's a vacuum Einstein solution. So two examples. If I take H is x squared minus y squared, then hij is going to look like, or a half hij, is going to look like 1 minus 1. And so what this corresponds to in terms of motion, because hij is telling me about the tidal tensor, is something which, when it gets longer in the x, in the y-axis, it gets shorter in the x-axis. And then, you know, if it was a sort of periodic wave, you'd have this motion which would be on a cross. You'd be getting longer in the y-direction, shorter in the x, shorter in the y-direction, longer in the x. And then if you take instead a slightly different combination, in this case, things get bigger at the same way in both the x and y directions. And so what you have is a pulse passing by now elongates along the lines at 45 degrees in the xy plane. So this represents the two polarization states of the gravitational wave. So I'm trying, what I've done here is taken two sort of very basic examples for H, just to sort of show you this is what a gravitational wave looks like in terms of the tidal tensor. So that was something which you could have done very easily, either way.
If we assume that the Poisson tensor of T A equals zero, or
yes, because I've actually said when I've written it here, this thing here, I've set T equals zero there.
So it's nothing we can derive from. T should be zero in our case.
No, we say that general relativity has a zero torsion. So this is something I'm inputting in order to derive what the curvature is. I'm saying I've got a torsion-free metric connection. I'm going to compute it. And so that's what I did. But I mean, you know, it was actually a fairly short computation to get to this point. You can sort of see it's not really filling up a lot of board space. So my second example something which I guess I would compact if, now hang on my spelling here, compactification is something that I would sort of put under a general category of warp compactification, which I'm not going to do it necessarily in full glory. I'm just going to do a sort of simple restriction or a simple case of something like this. When we do Kaluza-Klein theory, we'll see that when you have extra, you can have extra dimensions. Obviously, everything I've been saying about manifolds, I haven't really tied myself to four dimensions. So one of the things that we can explore in gravity is having extra dimensions that we somehow can't see, in which case we have to find a way of making our geometry look four-dimensional. And so one way is simply to make the extra dimensions very small, and another way is to glue ourselves to some submanifold, and we'll be looking at each of those possibilities. So the example I'd like to do here is something very general. I just want to say that I have one dimension dr, and in this case, the rules of the game are that g naught mu nu is a function of x mu. So I've got some, I was thinking four-dimensionally, this might be just some normal space-time metric, and I've got some extra transverse direction. That's what this is telling me. But there's a sort of clean separation in this case, that the way this metric depends on R is just by a common prefactor here, a squared of R. So what I want to do now is to compute the curvature of this space and to see how this extra dimension feeds in to somebody who's living in that geometry. Do they see the extra dimension? How do they see the extra dimension? What impact does it have? So again, I've got to do my orthonormal basis. So my orthonormal basis, I'm splitting off the R. My A index runs only over the dimensions of this internal piece here, or external piece, depending on which way it is. And so this is an orthonormal basis. Omega naught is an orthonormal basis for G naught mu nu. But I'm not going to say what G naught is. So if I now do my exterior differentiation, obviously d omega r is 0. And then d omega a is a primed dr cross omega naught a. And then plus a d of omega naught. So again, that's just writing down what the derivative is, but then I want to rewrite that in terms of my orthonormal basis. So I use Cartan's equation on the second term. So I'm doing Cartan's equation in the background metric G naught. And then the first term I've just kind of rewritten, shuffled a bit to get it in a convenient way, convenient form. So from this, I can peel off my connection one forms. Theta AB is just theta naught AB. And theta AR is A primed on A omega A. So again, in this example, it's just very, very straightforward to read off what the connection one forms are. So now I want to get the curvature. So if I look for the sort of space-time parts of the curvature, RAB is going to be d theta AB, remember, plus theta AC, wedge theta CB, plus theta AR, wedge theta RB. So I'm summing over. In my sum over cross terms, I must remember that there's also an R index in the full space-time. But then I see that theta AB is really just the same as theta naught. So this first pair of terms is simply R naught AB. And then the second pair of terms is going to be given by this second piece here. So I'm going to pick up an A primed on A squared from that. And then I've got omega A. And here, what I have to do to get theta RB is I have to first of all, I have to obviously lower my B index. I've got to swap the ordering, and then I have to raise the R index. So swapping the ordering gives me a minus sign. Raising the R index also gives me a minus sign. And so that means I end up with plus A primed on A squared. So just to write that out to emphasize any hidden factors of A. R naught AB is the curvature two form on the background metric, G naught. So that's just writing that out in full. And then, well, the second term I've already written, but I'll just write it again. With what I mean by that load index. So that's the most of the curvature two form computed. The only other component is RAR, which is going to be d theta AR plus theta AB cross theta BR. So theta AR here is A primed on A omega A. So that's just A primed omega naught A. I'm simply inputting what the expressions are for the connection one forms. And so what you see, when you take the exterior derivative of this, you first of all take the derivative of the A, so you get an A double primed, but you also have to take the exterior derivative of omega naught. But when you do that, that simply cancels with this term here. So you just end up with A double primed there. So if I want to peel off my Riemann components, so the first term, I get a 1 over a squared, because when I wrote that out, what r naught ab was, the curvature 2 form of the background metric, that's given in terms of the background basis of 1 forms, which is not the same as r full basis of 1 forms, and it's out by a factor of a. And then the second piece, which is coming here, remember this is the definition of the curvature 2 form, so I can see I've got an a primed on a squared, and what I'm ending up with is that I'm changing the two indices to an a and a b, and that's what delta ac e to bd will do, but it's got to be antisymmetric on c and d, hence that expression in brackets. So that is the expression for our ABCD, but again, just remember, this is in an orthonormal basis. So if I want to get the curvature in a coordinate basis, which is usually where you want to work if you're trying to solve equations of motion. So if I want coordinate basis, so if I want to get it in a coordinate basis, I've got to use the components of my the sort of transformation between my basis and the coordinate basis, both for the vector space and the covector space, to take me from orthonormal basis to coordinate basis. And so what you tend to see is that in most cases of use, that when you have one sort of contravariant, one covariant index, usually those factors, you know, of this transformation matrix and that one tend to cancel each other out. And so all you're left with are the sort of two sets of transformation matrices on the cotangent space, taking you from the orthonormal basis down to the coordinate basis. So in this case, our omega was equal to a omega naught. So you're basically getting a factor of a squared in the expression that you've got up here. So you end up essentially with this expression. So finally, just to sort of get the last, we've got ARBR is minus A double dot on A delta AB. And so this is telling us essentially what our mu R nu R is. So in terms of the Ricci, so what we see here is that we've got for our curvature, I mean, we've got this transverse component, an RR component. D is the dimensionality of the full space. So D minus one is the dimensionality of the sort of G, the mu nu, the space-time part. So in terms of if we were living in just G mu nu, what we would see, the overall Ricci curvature wouldn't just be the curvature of G naught. There would also be these extra pieces, the A prime squared and A double prime times our G naught mu nu. So in other words, we're picking up something which is a bit, from our perspective, a cosmological constant, because that A function depends only on R. So it's telling us how this, the effect of having this extra multiplicative factor, which is called a warp factor, how that feeds in into this, the lower dimensional space. And in particular, if this, what I've written up there, our metric, if our original metric is a solution of Einstein equations when G naught is eta, then our full metric, our general metric, will also be a solution provided that G naught is Ricci flat. So it's telling us something about what we can build up, what we can do, how we can sort of fit together space, different spaces or space times. So it's a means of merging things together. Now I did have one more example, but I don't think I can do it in a reasonable amount of time. So I'm going to stop here.